Thoroughbred Tales, taking you behind the scenes of the international horse racing and breeding industry.
Welcome to another episode of the Thoroughbred Tales podcast. And this week we have something a little bit different. We have Sam Hoskins of Kennet Valley Thoroughbreds, who's hosting for us during the week of Royal Ascot, where they have numerous runners to look forward to. Sam, welcome to Thoroughbred Tales.
Thank you, Sally Ann. It's a real privilege coming on this week and really looking forward to it.
Yeah, we're recording this before Royal Ascot, a little bit earlier than I normally record the podcast. Normally, people have had a couple of days of hosting. You've yet to take over the reins of Thoroughbred Tales, but we're worried that maybe you'll get caught up in the whole Royal Ascot madness later in the week. So we're just preempting it a little bit this week.
Well, that's the dream, definitely. If something miraculous happens, it gets very exciting. So, yeah, got to juggle a few balls if that's the case. But just to have we've got four runners, and just to have one horse just finishing in the top three or four would be amazing. But obviously, there's four dreams alive.
So tell us a little bit about the four runners you have this week.
So we've got a runner each day, three for KVT, Kennet Valley Thoroughbreds, and one for Hot to Trot Racing. We have Sabuska in the opening race of the meeting, which is tomorrow as we speak, Tuesday, in the Queen Anne Stakes. Sabuska has got a lot to find on ratings and on form, but his best form has come at this track, and he did win the Silver Hunt Cup last year, and he was fourth in the QE2 in October, where arguably, if he'd carried a straight line, he probably should have beaten Palace Pier. But we're under no illusions that form will hold its form for tomorrow, given Palace Pier will be back on his much favoured better ground. So realistically, we fear we're racing for second or third. But for us, a small syndicate, finishing second or third will be like a winner. So that is our dream. If we're in the top four, we'll be absolutely over the moon. And again, heading into Wednesday, we've got Hot to Trot Racing's Get Ahead, who's a filly that's leased off her breeders. She's a smart filly that won on her debut at Ascot early last month. And Clive's always thought the world of her. He's been cooing about her since sort of almost December time before Christmas, saying, "I think you've got a nice filly here." And it paid off. And Clive tends to know what he's got. And she did do the business in early May, when quite a few horses were fancied. She was very professional. She's had a racecourse gallop since. And look, there are 22 runners in there. It's going to be very, very hard. We are drawn next to one of the American horses in, that's in two and we're in three. So that's a good thing. Hopefully we can stalk her. She's a very useful filly. I mean, if she's in the top six, we'll be delighted. But she is smart, and I know Clive doesn't think she could be in the class of Heartache, and Heartache did win the Queen Mary for us a few years ago. So, but realistically, again, if we're in the top four, we'll be absolutely over the moon. So, and that's great. And then moving into Thursday and Friday, we've got two handicappers, both in the last two races of the respective cards. We've got a horse called Dance Fever, who hasn't been seen for a long time, but he's going to line up in the Buckingham Palace. He wouldn't want too much rain to come, but that said, we are starting the meeting on fast ground, so good ground or about is fine for him. He's a very interesting horse. He could be well handicapped, but as I said, we don't want too much rain for him. And then that is for the Clive Cox Yard, and with Adam Kirby on board again. And then we've got a quality running in the last race on the Friday, which is the Palace of Holyrood House Handicap. He's a very interesting horse. He won by a long way at Wolverhampton back at the end of April, and we've put him away and haven't run him since because he got his rating of 88. And whilst he probably isn't thrown in on bare form, but he has shown very good form on the gallops at home, and has shown that he's probably capable of being rated quite a bit higher than that. That said, there'll be a big field, 5 furlong, helter-skelter pace. It will be very hard, and he want decent enough ground as well, although I think probably good to soft is just about okay for him. But he's very interesting, and he is actually the antipost favourite, so the pressure will be on. That will be our last dart to fire, and again, I'd be hopeful he could be in the shake-up. But again, when you're against 25 other runners, what is a good result? Top four will be great.
It's brilliant that you've managed to have one runner each day, so you can spread it out, you know, even though you're saying you're a small enough syndicate, but to have four runners, one each day. And it means you get to enjoy 4 days of Royal Ascot, which is lots of people will be really jealous about because lots of us aren't going to be there this year.
Yeah, exactly. To be honest, I'd always go on the Tuesday, whether we've got a runner or not. And I'd probably go the other days when we've got runners. But usually it tends to not work out when you've got one a day. So I'm going 4 days this year, and I have to be top hatted and tailed. And I'm not sure, I'd be lying to say I enjoy that when it's really hot. It gets quite, I sort of, if I could go in shorts and t-shirts, I'd go every day without question. But I sort of don't mind one day in top hats and tails, but four in a row or even five in a row would be a lot. But I have to say this year, there's not going to be a huge crowd. I mean, 12,000 people is a lot, but it's nothing really for Ascot, where capacity is 70,000. So it will actually be probably quite a nice atmosphere there. Thursday and Friday should be a lot cooler, probably will get wet. But it is just really exciting, and it's great for a small syndicate to have runners there. And we're not going to have runners just for the days out. So it's actually nice to have horses going there that have actually got genuine chances. And we do actually have one more entry on the Friday, a horse called Spanish Kids in the Duke of Edinburgh, but he won't get in. But if he got in, he'd have a chance, but he's not going to get in. But we're not just there for the day out. We're there to be competitive, but just to go there with horses that can be competitive is really exciting. And that is the dream of owning a leg of a horse or running a syndicate.
I'll tell you a secret, Sam. Royal Ascot is my one meeting of the year that I enjoy watching men being uncomfortable in top hat and tails, because every other day of the year, women have to be uncomfortable in hats and high heels while I'm running around doing my job. So Royal Ascot is one of the days where I like that I don't actually have to work, that I can sit at home on the couch and watch all of you lot be uncomfortable. But it will just be nice to see crowds at a racecourse again. You know, we've only just started having owners back here in Ireland. But to have an atmosphere after what we saw at Cheltenham, where the stable lads had to, you know, try and create an atmosphere for the winners, it will be nice to see horses being applauded back into a winner's enclosure.
Oh, yeah, big time. Absolutely. I went to York a few weeks ago and we had a horse, Spanish Kiss, who I just mentioned, actually. He won at York and there were 4,000 people there. And it was just, I'm going to say electric, maybe that would be a bit overrating it, but it was an awesome atmosphere. And Spanish Kiss won. Just to make it extra special, there was a lady there who hadn't been racing since the whole of COVID. She lost her husband over the winter, not through COVID, I might add. She was there. She picked up the prize in tears. It was just so special. I mean, it was sort of, my emotions were kind of roller coasting because we haven't had any of that kind of stuff for so long. And it was such a good day. It really was. And luckily, again, we do have plenty of losers as well, but we did have a winner at Newbury last week called Semper Augustus, and he won. And that, again, that was just thrilling. It's just great just being on course. I hadn't, before Spanish Kiss, I hadn't been on course for a winner for about 15 months. And as I said, we do have the occasional winner, but most of them have been. Last year when Sebuska won the Silver Hunt Cup, I was at home on my sofa on my own, and I didn't really know what to do. I think I said to someone beforehand, jokingly, I'd run around the village naked if he won, but to be honest, pathetically, I didn't go ahead with that. But sometime I'll have to, if I make that, and I know now in the future I'm going to make promises, I have to do them.
But tell us a little bit about the syndicates that you run and how you got into this whole, because I know you're very passionate about, you know, syndicates and getting groups together and getting access for those groups into racecourses. So tell us a little bit about your path into where you've ended up being now.
So Luke Lillingson and myself set up Hot to Trot Racing back in 2011. We had first runners in 2012, and I was helping a man at the time. I was helping a bloodstock agent, Geoffrey Howson, and he looked after Nick Robinson that set up Kennet Valley. And Nick was one of the pioneers of sort of syndication. He set up Kennet Valley back in 1988 to target the Cartier Million sales races, and he was backed by Michael Smurfit to do this, and they set up and they did very well. I think they came second and third, and they won a lot of money, and they had a lot of success in the early days. In the old, they had gold and navy blue colours at the time. So Nick carried on running Kennet Valley, and that was with Harry Herbert, and Harry went off and set up Highclere, and then Nick sort of carried on, sort of, I think without Michael Smurfit, but carried on with his own, just running a small syndicate for many years. And Nick did very well. He punched well above his weight with somewhere between kind of 6 and 10 horses, and we took over, sort of Nick was probably getting on a little bit, and we took over in 2012. I think we had the first runner in 2013. And actually the first, we were very lucky to inherit Tullius off Nick, and Tullius is a real star. And for us won the Bet365 mile at Sandown. He won the York Stakes. He was second in the lock-in. She won the Diomed. I mean, it's so... And in the same... And our first yearling purchase was Magical Memory, who was also a star and won the Abernant and the Duke of York and was fourth and third in the Haylock Sprint Cup. And so we had two horses that were competing at Group 1 level early on. So that was absolutely amazing. And Hot Trot was going on in the background, and Hot Trot carried on with plenty of winners. And actually Hot Trot then in 2016 had a really poor year. And I remember thinking, oh dear, well, maybe the future is just Kennet Valley now. But then just as when you have a bad year, the next year comes and we had Heartache. And Heartache won the Queen Mary in 2017 for Hot Trot. And with the leasing game, everyone, that kind of snowballed a bit. And we gradually got offered more nice fillies to lease. And the following year, we had a couple of smart ones. And in 2019, Curious won the Coral Charge. And she plied it at Group 1 level sort of last season as well. So Hot Trot, that's Hot Trot's journey. In Kennet Valley, since Magical Memory and Tullius, we've had some good horses. And with Sabuska came along. And in Sabuska's crop, we had a horse called Persian Moon and Flashcard, who both were group placed horses as well. And so we've actually, that crop, we had six horses. I think three of them were pretty slow and three of them were group horses. So that is racehorse ownership. Everyone's going to have slow horses, but we're just trying to punch above our weight. And we've been really lucky. We wouldn't have huge sort of bundles of money to spend, but we go in there and buy horses as yearlings often and split them into 16 shares and go from there. And we put on, social side's really important. We put on lots of lunches and lots of stable visits and do a few extra other different events as well. And try and do our best communication wise, loads of videos of the horses. And we've had Zooms during lockdown. And this week we're having brunches each day before racing, which should be quite fun. So it's getting everyone together and win or lose, we'll have a drink beforehand anyway. And we just hope there's an excuse for a drink afterwards.
How many people are involved in your syndicates and what sort of people get involved? Do you find that there's people from all walks of life, or are they people who are already interested in racing and had ownership of other horses?
It's a really good mixture, and it's quite amusing when occasionally you're doing a lunch organize and you've got to put people next to each other and think, oh my gosh, you can't put that person next to that person because they're so different, but actually they've all got racing in common. So that's the really fun thing about it. It doesn't matter because everyone's got racing in common. There's such a variety, there really is. I mean, I'd say your sort of median person would be someone that perhaps might be a race, would be a member of a race course. Perhaps that would be more like Hop the Trot. In terms of Kennet Valley, perhaps there's quite a few people that perhaps have worked their lives and perhaps have got a bit more time now and they've got the time and money to enjoy it and really go that sort of, take that extra sort of interest. Some people have shares in lots of horses and are in loads of different syndicates. Some people, there's just their one share. That's their absolute main thing. And that's the same with Hot Trot. And Hot Trot, we've had lots of people who love all the events. Actually, sort of the success of the horse on the track is perhaps not so much. They just love all the trainer mornings and stuff. I mean, I know we've got a guy who's a retired farrier and he just loves going to all the trainer mornings to see how all the different trainers shoe and trim their horses. It's absolutely fascinating. So he loves it for that. And other people, yeah, it's a real social thing. And lockdown was sort of a worrying thing for us beforehand, but actually it kind of evolved and we did so many different things. And they said all the Zoom things were especially important. And certainly last sort of April, May, we did lots. And then this January, February, we did loads and loads. And I think that was a real sort of key time. Everyone really appreciated it because it was a gloomy time for everyone when you've been going through it for a long time. And just things, we did one every week. We had people like John Ox. We had people talking about art at the Munnings Museum. And we had Frederick Barley talking about the Mongol Derby and all these different things, trying to go sort of like different sides of racing. And it was Luke Livingston was talking about Mount Coot and buying broodmares and mating them. And Clive Webb Carter talking about pedigrees. We did all these different things, all these different facets in racing, which sometimes it's sort of, you're too busy to really go into much detail. But actually it was fun trying to sort of go into different sides of it whilst we were unable to meet in person.
Well, it's something that we feel strongly about at Thoroughbred Tales as well, is the same idea of trying to show people all the different sides of racing. We talked about it with Harry Eustace last week, that so many people don't realise that there's so much in it. It's more than just the racehorse on the racetrack. So it's really interesting to see all those other sides. But I know you mentioned there about leasing horses for your syndicate. How does that work? Can you explain that to our followers a little bit about leasing them as opposed to buying them from the yearling sales, which people might think is the traditional way of acquiring a racehorse?
Well, in days gone by, traditional breeders would sell the colts and keep the fillies. Nowadays, obviously there's a cross-section. There's still a lot of owner breeders that would like to do that, but sometimes it can be limited to those that can afford to do that because training fees have gone up and up, and prize money certainly in this country has, I'd say plateaued would be polite, but probably gone down in real terms is being fair. And obviously recently in the last year, there's obviously excuses for that, but it is very expensive. The rate of return for racehorse ownership is very low. So leasing horses, it can be winner-winner both sides, because for the breeder, they can retain ownership of their filly either to breed from it in the future or sell it, and they can have their horse race for free. And I mean, if it was an investment, it would seem lunacy for the likes of ourselves to come along and say, we'd like to lease your filly, we'll pay £25,000 a year to race her, and we'll when she wins one race and wins 3,000 and gets placed a few times and returns 6,000, we'll be all smiles and be delighted at our year's work. Well, that's winner-winner, because we've had a good time, we've had a winner, we've had some good runs and et cetera. And the breeder, who would have lost probably 20,000 quid racing their filly, has watched their filly race, and watched her post a massive loss, but she's seen her win, and they've done. We always campaign them sensibly. If they are good, we'll have a good go at trying to run them in black tight races and make them a winner first and foremost. And it can work really well. Some people who perhaps be breeders that would say, well, actually, if I own them myself, I'd be trying to sell them if they want a maiden. Well, that's probably leasing wouldn't be for them. But those who are looking for a filly with to keep the pedigree for the future, it can work really well for them. And we've worked well with some really quite major owners and breeders. And I mean, the likes of Whitsbury Manor over here work really well for us because they're breeding quite sort of fast and fairly precocious horses, which we're never in any rush with a horse. But at the same time, it is quite, probably we'd like horses that can, if you're leasing a horse at two, it's nice when they can run at two, because we can't afford to be sort of leasing too many really backward horses. That's the one downside from our perspective. But I mean, having horses that we're taking on that can run in sort of June, July, August, making a debut run, then it's perfect. And we go on and race them at three, and then usually then the breeder has the option of whether they retire them or sell them. And if we race them on at four, we'd ask for right of refusal to carry on at four.
Yeah, you're very vocal on social media and in the media about the access to the race courses for syndicates and the rights for syndicate members. Do you think that syndication, Harry Eustace mentioned it in last week's podcast again, about how big it is in Australia, do you think it's the way forward for British racing and racing in Europe in general?
Well, I do, and obviously I'm completely biased, and anyone would say, yeah, I would say that. But I do, because I get to see it firsthand about our best form of advertising ourselves is word of mouth. We've never had any money to spend on advertising, and we're trying to do a bit of stuff on social media at the moment, trying to sort of push it out there what we do, and we're an open house, and trying to put a bit about our sort of success and stuff. But other than that, really, it's word of mouth. We just try and gotta give people a good time. And if we can give people a good time and a good experience, and we bring more people in, and that's really worked. And Hot to Trot in particular, it's worked so well. So, and I'd like to think most syndicates hopefully give their people a really good time, because they know they don't, they'll jump ship and join someone else. So we're all very good friends. We're all friends, but we're all in competition as well on that. We're all trying to strive to give everyone a good time. And unfortunately, obviously there are sides, and certainly regulation will help syndication because it flushes out any of the bad eggs, etc. And it brings us all down when there's stories of people who perhaps let the side down. And I would say it is one of the things, it is very important to understand racing and how much it costs to train a racehorse. Setting up a syndicate overnight, you need to be well aware of how much it does cost, because you must over budget on horses rather than under budget, otherwise you get yourself in trouble. But it is great fun. Celebrating having a horse shared with other people is really good fun. The race course, yes, I have been quite vocal on it. And I'm a bit paranoid. I don't want to seem like I'm generally a constructive person that likes to come up with ideas. I've been on the ROA board for, I think it's my fifth year now, and I'm not sure how much I've achieved on it, but I do think things are gradually changing. I think the message is getting across. There's some race courses that have always been brilliant, but there are some that have never tried. And that's the frustrating thing. The disparity amongst race courses is the frustration, because it'd be so unfair when you say race courses, PLC are not doing enough, because that's not fair. Because, you know, if you go to somewhere like a Sandown or a York or whatever, they're just incredible. They go the extra mile for you. They're amazing. But then you go to others, which I'm not going to name, who really don't really get it. And actually it would be in their benefits to engage, because there are so many, there is extra spend on tracks. You never know. The more people you get on board who have got a leg in the horse, you never know. They might come back and take hospitality for their mother's 90th birthday, or they might sponsor a race with their company, or they might do whatever. And we ourselves might even take some kind of, might sponsor a race, etc. I know through our various syndicates, we usually sponsor about two or three races a year and take hospitality. So in the bigger picture, it shouldn't really be justifying, because obviously runners on track means media rights and means betting, which means levies as well. So I think that, and when prize money is poor, actually, I'm passionate about it. I would just speak of it if I was a sole owner. But in terms of syndication, actually, it is very important. But if the race is worth $4,500 or $5,000, it probably doesn't make as much difference to us as perhaps others. But that's not for say I would never, my interest in the whole sport in general are not for that. But when it is the case that an ownership numbers are feeling the pinch of prize money, splitting it up into shares, it splits up the losses as well. So it probably should suit race courses quite well to have those involved, where actually, and that's what people are doing. You see even the big owners are now splitting there, and having, say, an owner that would have an outright horse, they have a quarter and four. And you see it the whole many times, you see so many times, how many times you see sort of Andy Stewart's or Tim Siders, they have sort of shares in lots of different horses now, and it's fun to do that. It's probably not because they can't afford it, but they might have shares in sort of 8 to 10 horses with other mates or other leading owners in the yard, and it works really well, because it's better. I'd have thought you'd be better off having a quarter and four rather than the whole of one, but again, I am biased. So.
And tell us a little bit about yourself, Sam. How did you end up in the racing and breeding industry?
I was always mad about it from a young age. I used to go racing with my dad when I was younger. To local track was Cheltenham, and we also go to Chepstow for the Welsh National. I was very much jumping bred, really. My granny had a horse when I was about 10 or 11 called Errant Knight, and it was a point. She bought it off Oliver Sherwood, I think, at the horses and training sale. And anyway, it wasn't a star, but then it needed some time off. But then it went point to pointing, and it went and won quite a few point to points. And her and her friend said, well, we better put this under rules. This is quite good. So my granny's brother was a trainer called Martin Tate, who was quite a shrewd trainer back in the day. Was famous training a mare called Roger's Princess to win the Coral Cup, and was a shrewd cookie. And anyway, but the other lady said, we're not sending it to your brother, because it would always be the trainer's brother's sister. It will always be in the back box. It will always be the second. It will always come second to the big owner's horse. So my granny said, well, that's going to be very controversial. If we don't send it to my brother, then we better send it to the best around. So they sent it down to Martin Pipe. And I was, you know, they're still a 10-year-old kid. And you know, the horse won 16 races under rules, which is really unheard of. And sort of picked up sort of four novice hurdles in a row, I think, and ran in the 1995 Grand National, where I was there, and the jockey fell off between the first and the second. But I really got hooked by that. I used to win at sort of Stratford's and Newton Abbott's, and I was there in the school holidays and just absolutely loved it. And so I was well and truly hooked by then. And I was sort of writing for my local paper, age 16. I did, and I sort of went down. I sort of decided, sort of, I did a bit of gap year, worked in a racing yard in South Africa, and visited Kentucky when I was 19 in America. And then I did the course called the Irish National Stud Course. And I remember meeting your sister there. And, well, she wasn't on the course, but she was very much part of the group, the social group. And then I was trying to get on the Godolphin, it was then the Darley Flying Start course, but I didn't get that. But I got a scholarship called the Joss Collins Scholarship and went to New Zealand and America and did work experience at Highclere Racing, which was ironically relevant to what I later did. And then I got a job working for the Niarchos family in London, and I'd worked for them for 2.5 years. And whilst doing a bit of writing in between, I was sort of somehow found, yeah, Luke, and we did Hot to Trot together, and I started doing that and working a bit for Geoffrey Howson, and then went on to do Kennet Valley and sort of somehow, yeah, kind of evolved. But I think always it fitted quite well, because I always loved, when I was younger growing up, I used to do loads of waitering stuff, and I always liked talking to people, and I always attacked it from quite a few different sides. I love the form side, I love the pedigree side, and love the bloodstock side, and I like being quite social as well. So it kind of syndicates, it does fit in quite well to what my sort of general, what I generally do in life. So it's good fun.
Well, it sounds great fun, and hopefully your syndicates are going to have good fun this week and have a good week. I'm sure you're really excited. We're really excited about seeing it through your eyes at Royal Ascot, and we'll all be, I'm sure all the Thurber Tales followers will adopt your runners as their own, and we'll be cheering you on this week. But yeah, you have to remember us even in your celebrations if you have a winner.
Yeah, I will do indeed. Exactly. Well, yeah, exactly. It'd be good fun. Well, we'll try and get the viewers, feeling like they're a part of it a bit anyway. Exactly. So we'll look forward to it.
Well, looking forward to seeing what you get up to this week, Sam. Thank you very much for hosting, and thanks for talking to us today.
Thoroughbred Tales, taking you behind the scenes of the international horse racing and breeding industry.